Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is the U.S. breaking a promise to children at risk? Hello again, I'm Armin Almy, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Tens of thousands of children face murderous street gangs, extortion, and sexual violence in Central America. For those whose parents are legally in this country, President Obama promised an orderly alternative to the terrifying journey through Mexico. But until they pass laborious screening, including DNA testing, they have to stay where they are, whatever the dangers might be. It's been a year since the president promised escape. Only 90 kids have even been interviewed. None has been admitted to the United States. Today's talking point, the Missouri Tigers drive the university president out of office. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Olney, back with To the Point. It's been a year since President Obama promised a safe path to the United States for thousands of children in Central America, as long as they have parents who are legally in this country. But not a single child has found a way past bureaucratic obstacles, and thousands are still facing mortal danger at home. Today's talking point, black football players did not lead the protest against racism at the University of Missouri, but when they joined, the school's president was forced to resign. First, this news update. At the White House today, President Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met for the first time in more than a year. Despite their well-known disagreements, they pledged to get along. Here's Netanyahu.
Thank you for this opportunity to strengthen our friendship, which is strong, strengthen our alliance, which is strong.
The president said it's no secret that the two have disagreed on the Iran nuclear deal.
But we don't have a disagreement on the need to making sure that Iran does not get a nuclear weapon, and we don't have a disagreement about the importance of us blunting destabilizing activities that Iran may be taking place.
Stephen Mufsen is White House correspondent for the Washington Post. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
Everybody looks at body language when these people get together.
Yeah, well, at least they were looking at each other and leaning toward each other. So I think the body language was better than it's been on some other occasions, and I think they were working at that.
What's the purpose of this visit?
I think the purpose of this visit is to move beyond the Iran nuclear deal. Prime Minister Netanyahu clearly opposed it very strongly, and the president sees it as one of his signature achievements. But it's done, and so now the question is, where do things go from here? How do you deal with Iran now that you've struck this agreement? What happens in Syria? How do you deal with this wave of stabbings from Palestinians against Israeli citizens? And how do we, you know, work on our security agreements going forward?
Violence, of course, occurred in Jordan. Two or three Americans were killed by somebody who was wearing a uniform at that point. Did they talk about that incident?
They did, and it was an opportunity for the prime minister to express his condolences and his concern for those people. So it started on a sober note, but a more genuine one perhaps than some of the other occasions in the past.
Back to the nuclear deal with Iran, are there ways that Israel could, in fact, inhibit or distract from the implementation of that agreement?
Well, I think that would be I wouldn't expect that necessarily. But I think what's important for Israel is how does one deal with Iran's assistance for Hezbollah and Hamas? How do you deal with Iranian troops in Syria fighting for Assad, not very far from the Israeli border? And how do you do that in a way that, for you know, that the United States wants, which is to say a way that does not directly undercut the nuclear deal? So if you're going to pursue sanctions, what kind of sanctions, how they be targeted in a way that Iran doesn't feel like you're undoing the deal?
A lot of people in Washington, Republicans particularly, have said that the United States has not taken a strong enough stand in Syria. Is Netanyahu on that side? Does he want the United States to do more in terms of military activity there?
Well, I think that Israel has been careful not to get too involved on any one side. Obviously, they have no illusions about Assad. They've never been close there. But, you know, the specter of ISIS and some of these other Islamic groups, I think, is also sobering. So I think Israel just wants to stay out of it as much as possible. And so I think the focus will be in that direction.
The United States gives more military assistance to Israel than any other nation in the world under the Memorandum of Understanding, which is about to expire, or will anyway, in 2017.
Right.
Is that another issue they're going to discuss?
Absolutely. Israel's looking for certain things that it doesn't have now. F-35 fighters, which are stealthier than the fighters it has currently. Also, bombs that have smaller radius so that it makes it easier to try to pinpoint your opponents in crowded areas and avoid civilian casualties. So that's another important item. The whole level of assistance from the current $3.1 billion a year up to some higher level is something that Israel is also seeking. So this isn't an emergency. The current agreement lasts till fiscal year 2018. But it's a good time for Israel to press for it because I think the president wants to show he is standing by Israel and its security needs. And so from that point of view, they're both interested in moving up and seeing if they can make some progress now.
Just a few seconds left, but what about the stabbings? You mentioned those in Israel. Is there anything the U.S. can do about that?
Well, the U.S., I think, sees this as part of the tensions between Israelis and Palestinians. And that's one reason why one of the things going on is that the president is asking the prime minister to come up with actions that Israel could take unilaterally that would diffuse tensions and show the prime minister's commitment to a two-state solution, even if that's still pretty far away.
Okay, we'll see what happens when their meetings are over. And, of course, Netanyahu will be here in this country for a couple of days. Stephen Mufsin, a White House correspondent for The Washington Post, thanks a lot.
Thanks. Good to be here.
In a moment, is the U.S. breaking a promise to children at risk? This is To the Point from PRI.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on Olney back with To the Point. It has been a year since President Obama promised a legal way into the United States for tens of thousands of Central American children facing danger, even including murder, when they're at home. Some 5,400 kids have applied, but only 90 have even been interviewed. Not a single one has been allowed into the United States. Michael Scheer reported the story last week in the New York Times. Michael, good to have you with us.
Happy to be here, Warren.
Reacquaint us with the context in which the president said that he would try to set up this program to provide what was described as an orderly alternative to that dangerous, dangerous, terrifying journey through Mexico.
Right. So you'll remember it was the summer of 2013 when the number of children largely from Central America, started pouring across the southern border of the United States from Mexico in much greater numbers than had ever been the case, tens and tens of thousands of them, all of them trying to get into the United States, but to do so, making this incredibly dangerous trek, some of them by themselves, some of them families having paid smugglers who then you know, often cases treated them terribly. There were incidents of rape and murder and simply just death along the way. There were reports of kids traveling on the tops of trains and then falling off. I mean, it was a terrible thing. And so the United States did a whole lot of things to try to stop that, including trying to convince the Mexican authorities to increase their own protections along the Mexican southern border with Central American countries. But one of the things the United States said was, look, if you're a child in Central America and you have maybe a parent in the United States and you're trying to join up with that parent, rather than have to come to the United States and then claim to be a refugee, you could make that claim in the country that you were in, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and the United States would process that claim and then bring you to the United States. And that's what they set up a year ago, and that's what has taken so long.
Okay. Why is it that they have to stay in those countries and when the dangers to them are well known and endure that rather than coming here first?
Well, they don't have to. I mean, the process by which you can apply to be a refugee or apply for asylum in the United States still exists, and if they can make it to the United States safely and cross the border and say present themselves to authorities and say, here I am, I'm a refugee, that still exists. What the United States was trying to do was to say, right now there's an incentive for these kids, often unaccompanied by any adults, to be trying to make that awful, dangerous trek, and they wanted to give them the option of staying in their country and applying there, which they thought was actually more safe, despite the violence that they're subject to there, more safe than trying to travel across the country.
All right. We're talking about altogether tens of thousands of children who are at risk. This particular program would only have been for a relatively small number. What's the total?
Well, the total that have applied, it's interesting. They weren't sure how many people would actually have applied. They got about 5,400 applications across the three Central American countries I mentioned. That is obviously a small number, a small portion of the tens of thousands that came over. But keep in mind the key element that you have to satisfy to qualify for this program is that you have to have some kind of a relative here in the United States who essentially sponsors you, who says...
Any relative or a parent?
A parent, and it has to be... It does not have to be a citizen, but it has to be a legal resident.
Okay. So what has been the hang-up? Is it bureaucratic? Do they not have enough resources? Do they not have sufficient numbers of people from the United States in those countries? Do they have to travel down there in order to talk to these kids?
Well, to be fair to the State Department, which, I mean, they're one of the things that I reported in the story was the State Department said, look, you know, yes, the program has technically been open for a year, but the vast majority of these applications, several thousand of them, have only been made in the last, say, 4 or 5 months, just because it took time for the program to be kind of disseminated and for it to become known. So that's one of the pieces of the delay. But the other is that, you know, in order to not make a mistake and let somebody in who shouldn't be let in, if you're a child in Guatemala, say, and you have a parent here in the United States, there's actually a genetic test that has to be administered to both the parent and the child to confirm that you're related. It's just a cheek swab, you know, which they then send off to a lab. So that's one bureaucratic hurdle. Then there's a lot of paperwork. And then when you get to the point, you have to have an interview. And then after the interview, you actually, assuming you get through that and they say, yes, you are eligible, there's a whole other set of paperwork and you have to get airplane tickets. But the parent has to pay for the airplane ticket. So then you have to show proof of payment and all of that. And it just the advocates that I talk to for these children say it's just been a very long process.
Talking to Michael Shear with the New York Times, let's talk to one of those advocates. Lavinia Limon is president of the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants. That's a nonprofit refugee resettlement organization. Lavinia Limon, thanks so much for being on our program.
Thank you for having me, Warren.
You initially supported this idea. How do you feel about the way it's working out?
Yes, we promoted it over a year ago, hoping that there would be this alternative for some of these children. We knew it would be a relatively small program, and when the White House announced it, we said, okay, Now, you're going to do this in less than the 3 years it averages for you to bring in a refugee, right? Because these are children, and you need to move quicker. And they said, yes, yes, we're going to streamline the process, and we're going to move these children quicker. I think what we've seen is that the bureaucracy has no sense of urgency for these children or for refugees. The fact that it takes 3 years is ludicrous.
What about, though, what we just heard from Michael Scheer, that they had took them some time to get the program together? It's really only been since December that people have applied at all, and there is this complicated process involving DNA tests, among other things.
Right. The DNA tests, we understand, takes about 3 weeks to get the result. And I think the key is they've only interviewed 90 kids. They're planning to interview the second round. They had originally told us that the second round would be in about 6 months ago, but the Department of Homeland Security hasn't sent down any officers. And, again, they're supposed to do this soon. That's fine. I don't think it's a lack of resources. I think they have the officers to send down there. And I understand there's a lot of paperwork. I've been doing this business for a long time. But, again, you need to look at what, you know, how quickly should this be happening, or is this just business as usual? And what we're definitely seeing is business as usual.
You say there's not a lot of urgency, obviously, if you call it not business as usual, or just business as usual. But what about the need to make sure that these are not people who are fraudulently attempting to get into the country? Is that important?
Well, that's what the DNA test is about, right? The parents are here legally, and you have to, because they're children, you have to make sure you're sending a child to their parent, not to some trafficker or some bad guy or somebody pretending to be their parent. So we were complete support of the DNA test. But really, that's a very small part of this. There have been children who've been approved for months and months and months, and they have yet to move. And, you know, I don't know about you, but when I buy an airplane ticket, it takes me about 20 minutes, and that's if I want to compare prices. So, you know, I think it's really important that the Department of State look at all the steps they've set up for this and see what they can get rid of. So a child who, you know, I remember being 16 and summer lasted forever. Well, a year away is a lifetime for these kids, especially, as you mentioned, the kind of danger that they're in.
Lavinia Limon at the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants. Michael Scheer, back to you. This program started, of course, from the White House. Now it's in the State Department, the Department of Homeland Security. What is the White House saying about the issue of urgency that was just raised by Lavinia Limon?
Well, you know, I think they would probably, you know, they would argue that there is a sense of urgency. I think they would argue that, you know, despite the fact that it seems like it's taking a long time, it actually is, they would say, a little bit faster than the normal process, which, as Lavinia said, is just years long. I mean, if you're just sort of a refugee somewhere else in some other part of the world and say, hey, I'm a refugee and I want to come to the United States, it just takes forever. And so I think at this point their response is, you know, yes, we'd like it to go faster and we're trying, but, you know, but that's just how long it takes.
Bill Frelick is with us, Refugee Program Director for Human Rights Watch. Good to have you on our show.
Thank you for having me.
What do you think about this? As my understanding is that you've said this was pretty much a political decision.
Yeah, it is precisely that. I think it's a pretext for interdiction of Central Americans seeking asylum in the United States, but to get the Mexican government to stop the flow of Central Americans, send them back to their home countries, and say, why don't you wait in line back in Central America? As Lavinia Limon pointed out, however, qualifications for this program are very narrow, and in the best-case scenario, very, very few people are going to actually qualify for it because the qualifications are so narrow. There's, you know, six categories of legal status in the United States that enable a parent to petition for their child. And then the crux of the problem is really this contradiction that's a fundamental flaw of the program, that is you have to qualify as a refugee, meaning you have to have a well-founded fear of persecution in your home country. And that's just a fundamental contradiction to the refugee reality, which is, you know, you need to get the hell out of there. If somebody's threatening your life, you need to flee. And then you should be able to be processed from the place to which you fled, Mexico or Costa Rica or wherever it may be. But this program requires the child to stay inside the home country where their life is being threatened and requires them to stay there through this, you know, this tedious, enormously bureaucratic process.
Elaborate on your point that this is a pretext for interdiction. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think, you know, what happened in the summer of last year is you had the optics of tens of thousands of children and their families that were overcrowding detention centers in Texas at a time when comprehensive immigration reform was being debated here in the United States. And what President Obama wanted to show was control of the borders, that we do have control of our southern border. And he put enormous pressure on Mexico, which within weeks of Obama having declared this as a humanitarian crisis, the president of Mexico announced the southern border program. And what we saw was that in the period between the October of 2014 and April of 2015, when that program went into effect, there was a 75% increase in apprehensions and deportations from Mexico to these three Central American countries, at the same time that the apprehensions on the U.S. border dropped by 57%. So essentially, Mexico took over the job of deporting Central Americans, apprehending and deporting Central Americans without providing them protection in southern Mexico. The numbers that were apprehended rose 75%. The numbers actually deported rose 79%. The numbers that actually applied for asylum in Mexico were marginal. I mean, just not even worth mentioning. And so they really didn't have the option of protection there. They sped up the train that we talked about. They took other measures to prevent people from moving northward, setting up additional checkpoints throughout the South. I was there actually documenting a lot of that at the time, and did these essentially summary deportations, loading people onto buses and dumping them into, including children, into San Pedro Sula, which is the murder capital of Honduras. And this is a place where, you know, I was in the center where they deport children, and just watching them, you know, as soon as they hit there, within hours, the place emptying out as the kids were going, you know, 360 degrees in various directions. And I saw the same thing for the adults that were being taken to Corinto, which is the border crossing between at the Honduran, the northern Honduran border, where the buses would land. You know, I'd see five buses, you know, in a morning that would be deporting them from Mexico.
Let me interrupt you for a moment because we need to go to a break. I want to go quickly to Lavinia Limon with the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants. It's what Bill Frelick is saying suggests that this was a program that was never designed to succeed.
Well, Bill's absolutely right about the other measures that were taken to deal with this uncontrolled flood of people across the border, as it was deemed. But, you know, the in-country processing of refugees has happened other times in Vietnam and Cuba to keep people from getting on the boats and drowning at sea. From the Soviet Union, for the Jewish folks that would have an option of going to Israel or the United States, it can work when there's commitment to doing it, and it can work a lot quicker.
Okay. Excuse me. I'm going to interrupt you now and tell our listeners that we do need to go to a break, and we will come back, however, and continue this conversation with all of you who are on the program, and we'll add another as well. Later on our talking point, when the football team joined protests against racism at the University of Missouri, the school's president decided he did have to resign. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, talking today about CAM, the Central American Minors Program, minors meaning children, that was established a year ago by President Obama and has yet to have one person come to this country, even though that was the stated goal. Elizabeth G. Kennedy is a researcher and social scientist that focuses on the experience and needs of children and young people and forced migrants as well. She speaks to us today from Guatemala. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tell us what these children are looking at when they are required to stay home, whether it's Guatemala or Honduras or El Salvador.
Yeah, so we know that these three countries are three of the most dangerous countries in the world. A lot of times they don't register within the U.S. population or even internationally because they have small populations. Nonetheless, they do have the second, third, and 12th highest homicide rate in the world. So you're more likely to die in El Salvador, Honduras, or Guatemala than in declared war zones like Afghanistan and Iraq. And this is particularly the case for young people in their teenage years through their early 30s. So as far as what children are facing, I had done interviews with 322 between January and May of 2014, and over a third of them had been directly threatened to either join the gang or be killed if they did not do so. 22 of them who refused those threats were then beaten, and 14 of them had had a relative who had already been murdered.
So this is a very dangerous situation then. What is the perception of the Central American Minors Program if they know about it?
So that's the thing. Many people actually don't know about the program. I am in contact with children and families who are in the U.S. and then all three of the countries of origin and also Mexico. Still, by and large, it's a program that most people don't know about. Those who do know about it perceive that it's taking far too long. If you receive the threat that you're going to be killed today, that threat could be made real tomorrow, not a year from now, not even 6 months from now. And then the other problem is that for the parents, the biological parents, who might have been in the United States for 10 years or 15 years, they fled in some cases, but they didn't know that they could seek refugee status, and they also don't have legal status today. So I know of one young woman who has been raped by the gang. Her father was murdered by the gang. Her mother fled 10 years ago, and she is someone who would be great to be in the program, but because her mother was too afraid to seek asylum in the U.S., she doesn't qualify.
So there are many people then who are in a perilous situation but don't qualify for the reason you just stated, because they can't demonstrate that they have a legal parent in this country.
Exactly. And even among those who do have a legal parent in the United States, the wait time is too long. I know of several parents who were considering the program because no one wants to put their child in the hands of a trafficker or in the hands of a coyote, because they know that the route has become more dangerous. They know that Mexico has increased deportations, that children can fall off the train and be mutilated, that they could be disappeared, that they could be forced into slavery. But the reality is, again, if you receive a death threat today, that death threat could be made real tonight. It could be made real tomorrow. You know, it's not something that has a definitive timeline on it. And so all of those cases that I mentioned to you, the parents decided against using CAM and sent their children with a coyote instead.
Elizabeth G. Kennedy, let me turn back to Bill Frelick with the Human Rights Program, Refugee Program Director. This sounds like the definition of refugees.
Yeah, I mean, refugees by definition are people who flee their countries. So their lives are threatened, and they flee. That's chaotic. That's the reality. What the U.S. is trying to do is to create a neat, clean program, a bureaucratic program, but that doesn't really comport with the reality that these people are facing. And what it could do, tragically, let's hope it doesn't, is it tells a child who is under threat of death, a gang is threatening the kid's life, and it will convince the child to stay put where there's a threat where the government's not able to protect the child. And, you know, let's hope that, that some child doesn't die waiting for their number to come up for their interview.
Elizabeth Kennedy, what about the governments involved, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras? Are they unable or unwilling to protect these children?
They are largely unable and unwilling. These are incredibly poor nations that have very few resources. More problematically, there's well-documented corruption at every single level, from the local level to the departmental level to the national level. You know, we've seen that the former Guatemalan president had to resign amidst the huge corruption scheme. There's been ongoing complaints of corruption within Honduras. And in El Salvador, the FMLN government has been unwilling to address violence as the root cause of this migration and has instead blamed it on extreme poverty, which, of course, is a problem. But the issue is that the poorest neighborhoods are also the most violent.
Let me go back to Michael Scheer, the New York Times correspondent who began our program, and take us back once again to the time when this program was begun and what's happened since. Was there vocal opposition even to this program, which would serve so few people and apparently so serve them so poorly?
You know, I actually don't think there was, at least not that I picked up on. I'm sure there were some people who, you know, had concerns. I think, you know, what becomes clear when you listen to all of these great panelists is that if this system worked quickly, it may not be the be-all and end-all for the whole problem. Nothing probably is. But if it worked quickly in some whatever definition people might have for that, I think people might see it as at least one possible answer, right? If you were a child that was threatened and sitting in El Salvador or Guatemala, and you could apply for a program that within a matter of weeks or maybe a month would, you know, have you on a plane to the United States, people would probably see that as something that was at least a valuable or viable possibility. What really has gotten people upset is the question of the time that it takes. And if, if they've only interviewed 90 out of 5,400 people, even if they interview another 200 or 300 next month and another 300 or 400 the month after that, I mean, you still have the specter of kids sitting perhaps for 2 years, you know, a year and a half or 2 years, who have applied. And that just that raises all the issues that your panelists have talked about.
So, Bill Frelick, back to you with Human Rights Watch. You're saying, as I understand it, however, that it's not just a question of speed. It's the way the program is designed.
Yeah, I think that's the case. As I say, it does have a fundamental contradiction in it that it requires a person to establish a well-founded fear of persecution to qualify as a refugee and then require them to stay in their home country during that time. Having a family reunification program for separated families that's delinked to a protection need would be perfectly fine. You could have a humanitarian category for that. You could take as long as you need to establish the bona fides, do the DNA testing, whatever you needed to do. But you should have a refugee program that enables people that have to flee the country to be processed to be able to come to the United States in an orderly way. And you could do that from Costa Rica, Mexico, from wherever else. You could set up an emergency transit center, as exists in some other countries, to protect people outside of their home country and process them from there. These are all options. But to have a program that exclusively requires you to remain inside your home country, there's been no refugee resettlement of any Central Americans whatsoever. Adults, children, zero last year from any place at all. So there's been no ability of a person fleeing the country to be processed as a refugee and admitted to the United States from anywhere, inside their country or outside their country. And to set up a program that's based on these very, very narrow qualifications, that you have to match the narrow qualifications of the parent with the narrow qualifications of the child, really presents a false promise both to the people who actually might qualify because of this contradiction that requires them to stay in a dangerous place in order to get the benefit at the end of a year or so. But for those people who don't really qualify, who don't know, who don't have all the information, that are basically getting the message, you know, wait back in your home country. Don't come to the United States to seek asylum. Don't come here irregularly. They're sending that message out as well, at the same time that they're putting enormous resources into increasing the enforcement capacity of the Mexican government to stop people from making the trip, sending them back with the message, wait in line, wait your turn, and you can be processed in a safe way. It's a false promise. It doesn't really exist except for, you know, it's almost a hypothetical small number of people that would qualify, and even that, you know, is beset with this fundamental contradiction in the middle.
Elizabeth Kennedy, back to you. In Guatemala, you've also been in Honduras and El Salvador. You said you've interviewed 322 people who wanted to leave the country. You also mentioned several times the threats from gangs in those countries. What are these gangs, and where did they come from?
The two largest gangs in the Northern Triangle are Mara Salvatrucha 13 and Barrio 18, and both of these gangs actually started in Los Angeles and were essentially exported or deported to the Northern Triangle starting in the 1990s. And they were deported at the time that these, especially Guatemala and El Salvador, were ending civil wars. So it was not a good decision. It was one that the United States made, and one that continues to have very severe consequences for the region. You know, at the root cause of the gang is this extreme poverty, a lack of economic and educational opportunities, the same thing that we see in poor neighborhoods of the United States that also have gang problems. When kids don't have economic opportunities, when they don't have strong communities to support them, they will create, you know, alternative forces, but they've become very powerful here, and in many of the poorest neighborhoods are the most powerful actors.
So, Lavinia Limon, back to you with the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants. The United States apparently had a lot to do with creating the situation that these children are in the first place. What about our policy with regard to other countries? You mentioned Vietnam, for example, and Cuba. What can we learn from that?
We could learn that we can actually make something work, that we used to bring 120,000 Southeast Asians, and I can tell you, because I used to do it, the average processing time was about 3 or 4 months. I think we're going to have the opportunity to learn from Canada in the next couple of months. They're going to be bringing 25,000 Syrians to Canada, hopefully by the end of December. If you have the political will to do something, you can make something happen. And what we're seeing is, in the entire context, is the political will was to keep the kids from coming across the border and getting those pictures on television. That was the goal. They've achieved that through the kinds of measures that Bill was talking about in terms of interdiction in Mexico and whatnot. There was not the political will to make this program be a safe alternative in some sort of expeditious time frame.
Elizabeth Kennedy, what do you say from your standpoint in Central America about people who say, wait a minute, this is really not the United States' problem. We can't take all the refugees from all over the world.
Well, I would say, first of all, that this is a problem that the United States helped to create, as I outlined in response to your previous question. At the same time, the United States has adapted international refugee law into our national laws, which states that we will help those who do fear persecution and are unable or unwilling to seek protection from their governments. At the same time, these children and these families are our families. They're our brothers, our sisters. You know, many of the kids do actually have relatives who are in the United States, and we can't pretend that they're not, their futures aren't tied to our own.
Michael Shear, back to you, a White House correspondent for the New York Times. Are these issues discussed in this way in Washington and between the White House and the Congress when we're talking about a political will? Are the kind of challenges that we've just heard to the United States and its role in creating or appearing to have created problems abroad a part of the discussion?
You know, largely not. And I don't think anybody listening would be surprised by the idea that the kind of discussion that we've just had here for the last 15 or 20 minutes tends to get swamped in Washington by the broader discussions about immigration reform, the border fence, Donald Trump saying you'll build a wall, you know, that whole conversation. And when last summer when the children were crossing the border in such numbers, really it was debated here in Washington much more in the context, as I think one of the guests said, much more in the context of kind of what it means for the comprehensive immigration debate, what it means for kind of Obama and his ability to, you know, prove that he's securing the border so that he could have some sort of legislative victory in it. And it really, the kind of finer points here and really the focus on the children and their welfare was somewhat lost, although I will say that the White House and the State Department, you know, would argue if they were on this call, I think, that what they were trying to do here was to help, though, as your guests have shown, I think, maybe didn't work out the way they had hoped.
We did ask for a contribution from the White House, from the Obama administration, and we were turned down in that request. Lavinia Limon, back to you, U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, based on your long history, as you have described it. Do you think that things are going to get better anytime soon?
For this program or for the children?
For this program. And for the children, of course.
Well, I don't think so. I don't see the kind of changes that are being made. What we do know is there's been several children that have been interviewed, and they have come up through Mexico and joined their family here, not waiting for this program to actually work. So, no, I don't think so. The way that the programs are operating these days, what you hear is a lot of defensiveness, and I don't hear from the people who operate this program any new ideas on how to change it.
And Elizabeth Kennedy, speaking to us from Guatemala, final question to you. Is there any hope or sense of hope among the people that you have talked to there, particularly the 300 and some odd children that you've talked to?
There's always hope. I think one of the most hopeful signs has actually been here in Guatemala with the Criminal Court Against Impunity, which was created by a UN body and did result in the resignation of both the former president and former vice president. You know, there are community initiatives within each of these countries, and ultimately the reason that these refugees want to migrate is because of the hope that they have that they can locate a better opportunity, that they can develop themselves, get the education that they need, the money that they need to be able to support their families and their communities to become better. That's the idea that all of the kids had that I did talk with. They were afraid for their lives, but they stated unequivocally that once they were in the U.S., they wanted to take advantage of that opportunity, make themselves better, and be able to help others.
Thank you all very much for being on our program today. Elizabeth Kennedy, again, speaking to us from Guatemala, researcher, social scientist who focuses on the kind of experiences she has described. Bill Frelick, Refugee Program Director for Human Rights Watch. Lavinia Limon with the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants. And Michael Shear with the New York Times. Great to have you all. Thanks so much for being on our program. Black athletes have not always been in the forefront of civil rights protests, but if they choose to use it, football players have political power. We'll hear about an example on today's Talking Point.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
We're only here with today's Talking Point. The University of Missouri has seen weeks of protest over racism on campus, the use of racial epithets, and incidents including the drawing of a swastika on a dorm wall using human feces. University President Timothy Wolfe resisted demands that he resign until the football team joined a walkout. Here is what President Wolfe said today.
The frustration and anger that I see is clear, real, and I don't doubt it for a second. To the faculty and staff who have expressed their anger their frustration. It too is real. We need to use my resignation. Please, please use this resignation to heal.
Peniel Joseph is a professor at the University of Texas, Austin, where he is the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. He writes at The Root. Professor, always good to have you on our program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Warren.
Were you surprised when President Wolf resigned today?
No, not surprised at all, because what we've seen in Missouri, and we're seeing protests at Yale, we're seeing different protests all around the country on college campuses, was cascading series of protests since really Ferguson happened, but especially in the fall. And once it's very important to remember, the University of Missouri football players were really the last domino to fall. So there's been hundreds of students and even thousands coming to campus, coming together. Students have been doing, you know, one student did a hunger strike, but there's been students with tents and just camping in and doing teach-ins, all nonviolent, peaceful protests. The students did a peaceful action during their homecoming when the president was in a car. He refused to speak with them. So it's once the university football players stepped in and said they would not play this Saturday, the Board of Trustees, there was an incentive to say that this will not stand. A faculty were willing to do a walkout and go on strike with them. So this is, and Warren, I know you remember this, this is shades of 1967-68 in San Francisco State.
Sure.
This is a blast for the past that we're seeing happen all over the country. I mean, this is incredible.
How important is the participation of the football team? That costs the university some money if they won't play the game.
The football team is huge. What we're seeing is, historically, Warren, black athletes in the age of Jim Crow always did these kind of protests. We're thinking about Muhammad Ali, Jim Brown, but certainly the Olympic athletes who were led by Carlos and Smith, but Dr. Harry Edwards, right there in the Bay Area, who was leading these boycotts. What we've seen by the 80s and 90s was a much more pragmatic response, personified by Michael Jordan, who in 1992, when he refused to support a black candidate for the U.S. Senate in North Carolina against Jesse Helms, he remarked that Republicans buy shoes too. So he didn't want to put himself in any kind of partisan political situation. Right now, since the Black Lives Matter movement has erupted last year, what we've seen is a real awakening of political consciousness all across this country. Race is at the core, but it goes certainly beyond race. And so once these black athletes, at least 30 of them, they tweeted out that they said they felt ashamed that it had taken them that long to respond, because they've seen this movement on campus for social justice. So once that happened, schools stood to lose not just the $1 million that they were going to pay Brigham Young University, BYU, if they didn't play Saturday, but they could lose millions of more dollars by not playing Saturday, losing recruits, and this is terrible publicity and a terrible precedent.
Let's hear from Naomi Collier. She is a student at the University of Missouri. She's also president of the NAACP chapter there, and she spoke with CNN today.
It is unrealistic that this one instance is what's going to bring about change, but it's an excellent start, in my opinion, especially for university students to be able to see this. It's kind of an example of what culture should be like on university campuses.
So, Peniel Joseph, we heard the president resigning saying, use this resignation to heal. We've heard Naomi Collier saying, this is what the culture should be on university campuses. How much further is this likely to go, and what needs to be done?
Well, I think it's going to go much further, because you need substantive transformation institutionally at Missouri, and that's a few things. They need targeted numbers for faculty, staff, students, but they also need to transform the culture in terms of the curriculum on campus. There's so much hostility that black students have reported at U of M. They're about 7% of the student body. It's a predominantly white, predominantly well-to-do body. There needs to be a context where the administration in the school is saying that African-American students, and really all students, are welcome. Because the interesting part about this is that the black student demands, just like in the 60s, are connected to all these other students. So people who are Latinos, people who are women, people who are LGBT, if you create a more inclusive environment for African Americans, it transforms the whole culture of the university. So they're going to have real leadership. You're going to have a president who comes in and does even more than just get a chief office of diversity, which of course you need, but at a tangible level, at the classroom level, the university's relationship with the wider community. Many of the black students felt really hurt by the fact that the university never tried to do anything proactive in the aftermath of Ferguson and show leadership that we need racial equality in the United States. So what's interesting here is that much more needs to be done. This is symbolic and substantive, but you're going to see more protest at Mizzou if there's not real measures taking place to transform the culture of that university. And that starts with who you hire, who you let teach, what students you accept, and then programs of support and sustainability and accountability that are put in to make it a good and welcoming place for those groups of students.
Ferguson, a major topic, of course, in Columbia, Missouri. They're just a couple of hours apart. Columbia is where the University of Missouri is located. You said that Latinos and women and LGBT activists are all involved in this in one way or another. Is there building, do you think, some sort of critical mass?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've seen over the last 18 months really thousands of demonstrations all across the country that have brought millions of people together. We haven't seen, people like to say since the 1960s, but this is really, to be historically accurate, since the 1970s that we haven't seen protests like this. We think about Kent State in 1970. There was major campus strikes, sometimes involving athletes, sometimes not, in the early 1970s, all across this university, for everything from ending the war in Vietnam to having black studies, women's studies, Latino studies, all these different ethnic studies programs, and that was really about transforming campus culture. And what we're seeing really 50 years later is the echoes in a whole new movement really connected by social media, because social media has become the fifth estate beyond corporate media, where young people are speaking to each other on Instagram and Facebook and Snapchat and Twitter, and they're getting all this solidarity that goes beyond the individual location that they're at. So what we're seeing is a movement that this Black Lives Matter movement is spreading across the United States, and even as we think it's specific because of that title, it's really universal, just like the 1960s, which was a movement for broad-based social justice, radical democracy. And I think, you know, again, Missouri's happening. There's protests happening at Yale. I was speaking at McAllister College in Minnesota this past Friday. Hundreds of students came to a talk on civil rights and Black Lives Matter. So this movement is really happening.
Peniel Joseph, formerly at Tufts, now a history professor, founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas, Austin. Always great to talk with you, writing about this at The Root. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.